Welcome to Sacrilegious Discourse.
For this is what the Sovereign Lord says.
Why do you need prophets to tell people who you are and what you want?
If you can justify everything that the God of the Bible has done, then you can justify any of your behavior.
A lot of this mentality is trickling into what is now mainstream right-wing Christianity.
I am capable of empathy greater than this God of the Bible.
This is a Bible that they tell kids. This is the good Lord. This is the good book. He is fantasizing about murder, mass murder.
Head over to sacrilegiousdiscourse.com right now to find out how to leave us a review or support us on Patreon.
Husband!
I think you already used that one.
So why is it like shocking?
I don't know. I just like, you gotta be more original.
Do you know what we're doing today?
So we just did our Q&A over 14 and 15 of Matthew.
Correct.
Which would mean, since we have two Q&As that we're doing, that today we're doing
our Q&A part two, covering Little Maddie chapter 16.
All right. Let's do this.
Okie dokie. All right, we are hopping into our Q&A covering Little Maddie chapter 16.
Okay.
And if you recall, chapter 16 was where we decided that we're so done with Jesus and we hate him. I mean, last chapter he was racist, and this chapter right. We were
it
like,
doesn't get any better.
It gets worse. Yeah.
It is. I see how people can twist this into something good, mm-hmm. but like reading through it, it does not sound good at all.
It's not for me, dog.
Right. Yeah.
It's a no for
me. And it's so just blatantly whatever. We'll discuss as we go along.
Sure. So this chapter marks a major structural shift, which we noted. It seemed very different from previous chapters. To the point that I had to look up, was this chapter written at a different time entirely or by different people or something? And apparently not. Scholars don't seem to think so.
Okay.
Matthew was like, okay, we've done this and now we're doing that.
It feels like though they shifted gear, like whoever was writing this shifted gears as to this was information without the knowledge of Jesus's resurrection. Mm-hmm. Now we're going into something different.
Yeah. Many scholars actually do divide the book of Matthew into two parts.
Oh, okay.
And the first half is who is Jesus? And the second half is how will Jesus die?
Right. Yeah. And like we jumped right into that and I'm like, oh, okay.
This chapter is the hinge.
Right.
And we noticed it. So yay us.
Right. And now they're creating a prophecy in the same book that we're going to get the prophecy.
Yes.
I'm like, this is just really weird.
It's so bad.
Yeah.
It's very badly done. Up till now, Matthew, and when I say Matthew, of course, I mean Matthew, his team, Matthew et al., whatever, has mostly been showing Jesus like actively doing stuff like miracles, debates, teachings, parables, like interacting either with the people, with his disciples, or with the Pharisees, etc.
Yeah.
Right? This chapter, the narrative pivots towards Jerusalem and Jesus' death. Like, he starts talking about, okay, this is how I'm going to go. We need to get real now.
Yeah.
And it was very weird. So the chapter opens with the Sadducees and the Pharisees demanding a sign from Jesus. And we're like, again.
Right.
Right.
How many times we got to do this?
And Jesus responds, dudes, my guys, you can read the weather, but you can't read the signs of the times. And then I started singing Harry Styles.
Right.
Because that's appropriate.
Sure.
Basically, what he was saying is, you know how to interpret ordinary events, but you're missing what's happening right in fucking front of you. And our argument would be, yeah, but that shit was happening whether you were there or not, because magic was on every street corner. Politics was politicking, and prophets were profiting.
Yeah, they've kind of done themselves a disservice by announcing that those things were commonplace.
Yeah.
In this book. Like, they don't hide that fact.
Exactly.
And look, I don't believe that there was miracles in every corner. I don't believe that this shit was actually happening. But regardless, people at that time believed that that was the case.
There were grifters, and there were people profiting off of that, and there were people who believed in it. And there were things that people don't understand happening.
Right.
So between all of those, it was all popping off.
Sure.
And Jesus took advantage of that. And he's like, but why can't you pick me, fuckers?
Yeah.
And the answer is because you're just not special, except for your really weird, let's not be Jewish stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that makes you weird, but that makes you stand out in a way that we as Jewish people do not fucking like.
Right. Yeah.
Yahweh's not on your side, guy.
We want no part of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So the religious leaders keep asking for proof. And Jesus is like, you're standing in the middle of the proof. And so Jesus like starts going off like he's like, John the Baptist appeared. The crowds are following me around. They're flocking to me. Healings are happening. You've seen those. We've done those. Exorcisms. We've got rid of demons, you know, because those are real.
Yeah.
And people have come back to life. The kingdom of God is being preached. And you're standing right in the middle. And they're like, yeah, uh-huh. Just like everybody else is
right,
doing.
Right.
Again, you're not special. And as a matter of fact, you're dangerous. Go
right,
away.
Right.
So then Jesus says something that made me and you go, what? He said, no sign will be given except the sign of Jonah.
Yeah, that was weird.
What does that even mean?
Right.
That Jonah wasn't a sign. Jonah was a story. Like, what?
But this makes me, like, I've heard Jonah, he's been brought up in apocalyptic current day prophecy things mm-hmm. that people say.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of wondered about that. And yeah. This must tie it in somehow.
It does, but not satisfactorily. It's not like real good.
Okay.
This phrase does appear several times in the Gospels, and Matthew later is going to explain. So we will see what he means when we get there.
Okay.
But basically, it comes down to the fact that Jonah spent 3 days in a fish, and likewise, Jesus will spend 3 days in a tomb. And there it is. That's the whole connection. Yeah.
Okay.
Apparently, Jonah's time in the whale is supposed to foreshadow Jesus's time in the tomb because three.
In no way whatsoever.
Right.
There's so much. I mean, like, when Bible scholars look at Jonah, it's not seen as a literal event. It's seen as a fucking
story.
Yeah, it's a story
of a time when the Israelites had been shattered, smothered, covered, like spread to the winds, and Jonah was sent supposedly to go try and get this one city to redeem itself.
Right.
And so it was a story that was meant to try to bring all of the exiled Jews in all of the various places together.
Right. Right.
And to make them remember their heritage as one people, regardless of where they may live. And don't forget your Jewish ancestry. And, you know, we are a people. We are one.
Well, and you could maybe sell the whole Jonah connection to me a little bit better if Jesus was more of a reluctant prophet as opposed to like a fucking salesman.
Right, right.
He's a goddamn salesman.
He is. He's a Trumpy grifter.
Right.
And yeah, I'm not for him.
Yeah.
But this is one of Matthew's favorite literary techniques, and he does this all through the book of Matthew.
Sure.
He will find something in Jewish scripture, something random, like a one-off, or just something that's just like, again, random.
They're throwing prophecy spaghetti at the wall.
Yeah, and he will reinterpret it as secretly pointing to Jesus because it's convenient.
And that's how this whole world now operates.
Yes.
Like people take anything and mm-hmm. associate it with Jesus and God and religion and whatever. And it's like, no, how did you make that fucking leap? Like, where did you, what?
Right. You know? Exactly.
And this is the same shit.
So most modern scholars pretty much agree that this is Matthew reading Jesus's death backward into the Jonah story.
Yeah.
Like, no kidding. We even knew that.
Especially given that this was written after Jesus's death, right? They're trying to find some sort of a solace in that their leader died, you know?
Right.
Like, how does this make sense? Well, let's connect it to this. Let's connect it to that.
Right.
You know?
It makes me happy that you and I, as, again, neither scholars nor academics,
yeah,
we could see this easily. That right. means it's not that difficult to discern that that's what's happening. And scholars are like, yep, good job, guys. Which makes me happy. Like, I love it when our thoughts are confirmed by my studies.
Yeah.
The book of Jonah is actually not predicting a future Messiah, just to put it out there.
Nothing, and let's just be clear, nothing in the Old Testament is predicting a future Messiah. There are, let me strike that back. There are a couple of points where there is something referenced to a future Messiah.
But they meant it like in the next day or year.
Generally, but nothing specific and nothing that points towards Jesus at all.
Right.
So other than if you want to interpret him, like, unless you backfill like they're doing.
Right. Like, exactly. That's what this story is.
Right.
This whole thing.
Yeah.
And it just makes me mad.
Yeah.
Because it's not even trying that hard.
Right.
So then we get to the part where Jesus tells his buddies, don't forget the leaven or whatever.
Yeah.
The yeast, right?
Yeah, the yeast, right.
He cautions the disciples to beware of false teachings.
Sure.
And we were like, what the fuck is that about? Why is he talking about yeast and bread again? And Peter's like, we forgot the bread.
Well, I said at the time, like, they equated yeast to spreading. So, like,
right.
They're worried about the message from the Pharisees spreading further. And
yes.
don't let that idea infect you guys, you know, right. whatever.
But Peter is always portrayed as a dum-dum.
Sure.
So he thought, he took it literally. And Jesus was like, you're fucking thick, bro. So our question was, God, why do the disciples keep forgetting about the fucking bread? Like, he has literally fed them the masses twice now.
Yeah.
With, like, pocket bread.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Here's why he does that. Because the story requires him to.
Right. Yeah. Convenience.
Yes.
For the story. For the fiction that is being written.
He did it for the gram, you know? Yeah. Every time Jesus mentions bread or yeast, my guys panic. Tucci gang is like, what are we going to do? And even though by now he's fed 5,000, he's fed 4,000, he's walked on water, he's healed countless people, he's brought them back to life, he's performed miracles, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
They're always like, oh no, what a dilemma. How will we ever get out of this?
Right.
And that's intentional. It's
intentional, but it also, like, if you're reading this from a skeptical point of view, it takes away from the legitimacy of the story, because you can no longer at that point actually read it in a this actually happened mindset.
I can't take it seriously because that's stupid.
Right. You have to at that point at least interpret it, at the very least, interpret it as a metaphor for things that they're trying to describe. Right.
Artistic license.
Yeah. And I'm okay with that if people could admit that.
Yeah. And let's not pretend this really happened, guys.
Right, yeah.
That's silly,
right.
Because that's not what would happen.
Yeah.
You know? The story isn't trying to portray them as smart, which we obviously picked up on.
Right.
Matthew has no problem making them out to be dum-dums.
Yeah.
He is actually, in fact, trying to portray them as slow learners, and this serves several purposes, which will be obvious to you. I mean, they were obvious to us at the time.
Yeah.
It makes Jesus the smartest guy in every room at all times.
Sure.
He has all the answers. He knows everything.
Right.
He's the one that has to explain it. He's the master, right?
I mean, he is the Son of God.
He is.
He has to have all the answers, right?
And it's a good reminder,
right?
This is common ancient literary technique that's used multiple times. Everybody around you is dumb. That way, you're automatically smart.
Right. Make them stand out.
Yeah.
Right.
Another point is that it makes the disciples relatable to readers at the time.
Sure.
Not to us, because we're like, y'all too dumb. the audience is supposed to think, oh, I probably would have missed that too.
Yeah.
But we've all gone to school and had some English classes at this point, so we understand literary references, and we understand parables, and we understand morals, and we understand analogies. Like, right, these are all terms we learn.
Taking yourself outside, out of our current time period, right, and going mm-hmm. back 2,000 years when there was, when there weren't printing presses, there weren't, you know, formal sure. education as well as it's done today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these things didn't exist in any real structured manner. So you're talking to people who are a little bit thick, you know,
sure.
and so the relatability factor makes sense for that time frame.
It does. It does. But here, you know, counterpoint, it doesn't make sense for the word of God to last 2,000 years that I'm supposed to believe is divine and flawless.
Yeah.
If that was true, it would not be like this, because we have progressed. We have learned things.
Yeah, and that's not even accounting for the fact that it's been translated thousands upon thousands right. of times into and out of different, you know, languages and cultures and everything else, and
culminating in Trump's Bible.
To the point where at this point we often don't even know what certain words mean, and
what, you know, messages, like, or how locations?
Can God's message be clear if we can't even know all of the messages? It's, you know, it needs an update, obviously.
From
God, preferably, so that it makes sense for our you know world that's here today.
God failed.
I'm just, it's not.
I'm sorry, but God failed.
Exactly.
Like, if I am to believe that there is a God, a magical higher power being who is all knowing, infallible, etc.
Right.
You're doing a bad job of making me believe that, because
you're making us interpret it through goat herders' points of view.
2,000-year-old goat herders.
Right.
And that's not relevant to today.
Yeah.
That these things are not correct. So that's just another reminder that if there is a God, Yahweh ain't it.
Right.
I tend to believe there isn't one. But
I definitely believe there isn't one.
Right.
Like, but there's no tending about it.
I'm just like, I'm here to say that we can have the other discussions about all the other gods another day.
Sure.
But Yahweh ain't it.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
He sucks.
Yeah.
So the third point is that it creates teaching opportunities to present them as dum-dums. If the disciples understood everything immediately, then Jesus wouldn't have anyone to explain things to. So it's audience benefit.
Sure.
Which, that's the most obvious reason that we pointed out at the time.
But also, why do you need to repeat the same shit?
Because people are thick.
Right.
And also because it gives pastors lots of material every Sunday. They can do a different one.
Right. If you didn't like this bread handing out, you can use the other one.
Yeah. Yeah. Or you can make a lesson out of the fact that he does it twice, and why, and what's the difference. And, like, yeah, I can write an essay on all of that, you know?
Yeah.
It can't be difficult.
Right.
So,
But the things that that were missing, like, I have gone to church, right? Like, that's a thing that I have done.
Mm-hmm.
I went with friends when I was younger. We went for a while when we were first married. Like, mm-hmm. there was that we've told that story before. It wasn't like we weren't religious, but we went. And our pastor knew that we weren't religious, you know?
Yeah.
But I've never heard anybody, to the point that we do it, ask the questions that need to be asked.
Right.
You know, like, it's very much a sales pitch anytime you go to a church.
Yeah.
And there's different types of sales pitches. Like, that church that we went to when we were married, when we went to earlier when we were married, that was closest to anything that I would have taken as something that I could have been okay with.
Because it was more about teaching about Jewish life and Jewish history.
That pastor was very much about history.
Yeah.
It was a great learning experience for us with regard to what Christianity is. And, you know, that's the closest I've come to being intrigued by a church
And he also
in my life.
He also treated our questions respectably.
Absolutely.
He was not put out that we were atheists, and he was not put out. He didn't feel like threatened when we were like, I don't understand this. This doesn't make sense. I can't buy this.
Yeah.
And he wasn't threatened by that.
Right.
And, you know, he's a great guy.
Spoiler, he turned into an atheist himself.
Yeah. Not because of us.
No, not because of us.
He was just too smart, I think.
Yeah, we met up years later after we went to his church, and we found out through somebody else. Through the grapevine that he had turned atheist.
Yeah.
And we're like, what?
Yeah.
We need to talk to him.
And we did. We met up with him.
We want to do an interview at some point, but we haven't had a chance. We're really bad at doing interviews.
Like, we are. It's
not the interview itself, but like planning, getting it all worked out.
His life was kind of in a shambles at the moment too, because I think one of his daughters was getting married. One of his daughters was graduating from high school, and they were buying a new house.
Right.
All of those things were happening at the same time. And then we just haven't hooked up since then.
Sure.
And this was a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And we're just bad at follow through and interviews.
We really
so,
are.
You know, maybe some decade.
Yeah.
We'll see. All right. So moving on, we get Peter's confession. And Jesus asked the disciples to tell him, so what are they saying around town?
Yeah.
And he's like, what's going on? What's the hot goss? Who are they saying is the one?
Yeah.
And so our question is, why was Jesus asking for the local gossip? Was he like being a pick me girl?
Right.
Are they talking about me? Are they saying it's me? And that's what I literally thought.
Yeah.
Honestly. But it wasn't about that.
Okay.
Okay. He pretty much already knew what people were saying, and he was setting up the guys to have them publicly commit. He's basically telling them, what are they saying? Okay, now what do you say?
Right.
And he's saying, it's time for you to choose a side. You've been following me. You've seen all I can do. I've given you powers to do it yourself.
Right.
And it's time for you to like actually say the words, like make the verbal commitment here and now. Who do they think is the one? Okay, not me. But here and now, to my face, who do you think is the one?
Right. When they were discussing, like, okay, this part bothered me because like you said, he's trying to get them to commit. He's trying to get them to whatever.
Yeah.
But
awkward.
They hadn't been telling, quote unquote, anybody that he was the Son of God.
Right.
But they all apparently knew it.
Mm-hmm.
And you would think that these people closest to him would be very much on board without question.
Right.
If they actually did believe, like the fact that he's having to ask for a buy-in.
Yeah.
Still sounds very cultish and unsure of whether or not he is the Son of God, because they obviously know that he has some things that are just normal. He's not doing all these crazy things that they're talking about.
Well, it also strikes me as another instance of audience benefit. Like, he is intentionally pushing them to make the announcement so that they are on record in front of each other and to his face and for the readers.
Sure.
And that's annoying.
It is. It is.
I'm like, that's not necessary, sir.
Especially given all of the things that they claim that he has done.
Yeah.
We should, without question, believe that these people already are bought in.
Except that, again, everybody was doing this shit. Except for walking on water stuff. The weather stuff.
Right. No, I...
The other stuff, the bringing people back from the dead and the healing of the, you know, ailments and diseases and exorcising demons. Apparently that shit was happening all over the place.
I'm going to really need him to take a sword and take down a war elephant and then not get squished by it.
Yeah.
That'd be the one right there.
That was that guy from Maccabees.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, side note, though.
Yeah.
This all happened in this town called Caesarea Philippi. Do you remember? I had a hard time.
Yeah.
I still have a hard time. I don't know if that's correct.
Right.
But this is where Peter's confession happens, this town.
Okay.
And this is a fascinating location.
Okay. All right.
It's not Jerusalem. It's not even a particularly Jewish city where this happens.
Okay.
It's actually a center for Greek religion, Roman imperial cult worship, and the god Pan.
Huh.
Yeah. That's it's like the least Jewish place possible.
Right.
Is where Jesus confronts them and says, okay, here in, you're not surrounded by Jewish people. There's nobody here for you to be like, oh, let me go talk to my brother. I'm not sure.
Right.
Let me go. I'm going to go talk to my mom and dad about this.
Yeah.
Like you can't. You're surrounded by everybody around you doesn't believe.
There's an aspect to this where it feels like maybe Jesus takes them out of their comfort zones so that they feel more tied to him.
Yes. You know?
Like that's part of this growth that they did is like if you go to these foreign places and see the way that they worship that is very foreign to you.
Very different, very foreign.
Then that cultish, family-ish behavior that they want to solidify within this Jesus cult becomes even more solid.
It's almost like how the trauma bond works.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Just they've all experienced these things together and it further solidifies their relationship.
Right. Right.
And, you know, seals the cultiness of it.
Yeah.
So there were temples all over the place in the city. And some scholars think that Matthew intentionally placed Peter's declaration here because it creates that dramatic contrast that I said.
Okay.
And it's a city full of competing gods, not just one god. Like, it's not just that it's the Greek god, right?
Right.
It's not just that it's the Roman.
They got a fuck ton of gods.
They've got gods on every street corner, just like where we've been. There were angels and demons on every street corner.
Right, right.
Right?
Yeah.
So, in front, surrounded by all of these competing gods, Peter tells Jesus, you're the true one. Mm. You're the true God.
Okay.
And that makes it that much more meaningful and important in the story.
Okay.
For us, I'm like, I see what you did there.
Right. But it does have the, over time, it has the effect of losing some of that meaning to us because obviously we don't know that without digging in and finding out.
And also because we know how cults work now, because again, Google, and we can learn and understand that that was a tactic. Whereas they wouldn't have known that at the time.
And it doesn't, honestly, it doesn't help build their case either.
No.
Really.
Actually, it makes it more a case for grifters going to grift.
Right.
Grifters understand how to lead people and how to gain followship.
Right.
So we get Peter's confession and then Jesus compliments Peter for his bold and correct declaration. Okay.
Okay.
And he says, you are so Peter. You, Peter, are the Peteriest Peter that ever
Which
Petered.
Is rock.
Yeah. You're Peter.
Because Peter means rock.
Yeah.
So just because Peter is the rock that the church was built on.
Yes.
It's a thing.
A pun on a pun. It's a word in a word game with words.
I just want to make sure we said that there.
Yeah. So after Peter's confession, Jesus says, you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. And so this verse in and of itself has launched nearly 2,000 years of argument.
Mm.
Okay.
Okay.
The Catholic's interpretation is that Peter is the rock. Jesus is establishing Peter as the leader of the church.
Okay.
And this becomes the basis for papal authority.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
That is a small fucking bit to base an entire goddamn power structure on.
I mean, Jesus like said it straight though. It's hard to argue with if you want that to be your basis. It's hard to argue since he said it straight. You are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church.
But there's so many ways you could interpret that. You could interpret it as the faith and devotion that he has given to Jesus is what he's building the church on.
Yeah.
You could, I mean, like you could take that in so many different ways, and to say, this is why we have this specific power structure and we're going to base it all on this fucking line here from the New Testament.
Yeah.
Is a little shaky.
Among
other things.
Not to them. They thought it was real solid.
Sure.
Solid as a rock.
Solid as a rock.
Yeah. So that's the Catholic interpretation.
Yeah.
And I see where they got it. I see what they were doing.
Oh, yeah.
The Protestant interpretation is that Peter's confession is the rock, not Peter himself.
Kind of where I was going with it, but...
But regardless, there's some Greek wordplay here, because as you pointed out, the word Peter means rock.
Yeah.
And the word rock is also Petra. And so basically what he's saying is, oh, rock, you're my rock. You're a rock, rock.
Yeah.
And that would have been... I'm gonna
build my church on the rock.
Yeah.
Which is the rock and the rock.
Yeah.
And
the rock is... He's like, oh, Rocky, you're so rock. And like that would have been funny to them.
Sure. Yeah. No, it's
and I mean, clever. Clever wordplay. Me
now. Right. Yeah.
It's clever wordplay.
Sure.
I mean, I love me a good literary pun. It's not good as far as like holding up over time. It's not even a good dad joke.
Right.
But I'm like, I see what you did there. Rocky, right. You're my rock.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So here's another side note. Okay. So we just talked about that town and then we talked about the rock. Okay.
Yeah.
Then we had the gates of Hades and we were like, what the fuck?
Right.
Because it says the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it.
Right.
And we were like, what does that even mean? What is happening here?
Yeah. And why are we invoking, you know, a different religion?
Yes.
In the New Testament.
This is so weird.
Right. Right.
This is so not Jewish.
Yeah.
This is so like, and we're off into Christianity. Yeah, like, we go.
Did you ever know prior to reading this that Hades actually enters into?
I had no idea.
The New Testament.
I had no idea that such a Greek term
right.
would be utilized by Jews breaking away from Christianity to form, or I'm sorry, Jews breaking away from Judaism to form their new Christian sect.
Right.
Like, I had no idea.
Right, yeah.
So, it doesn't actually mean what a lot of people think it means.
Okay.
How could it?
I mean, okay.
So, many modern Christians interpret this as, hell won't defeat the church.
Okay.
Because, you know, the gates will hold it back. The gates of heaven will hold it back. Like the gates of Hades.
But you're invoking Hades.
Right.
Which is specifically not Christian.
Yeah. And the argument is that gates are defensive structures. Like gates don't attack. The gates weren't ever going to get you.
Yeah.
So what are you talking about here?
Right.
Some scholars argue that the image is actually death itself, because remember, to Christians, Hades means hell, right? But to the Greeks, Hades was just the dead.
Okay.
Right?
Right.
Like, not like you're punished for your sins. It's just the land of the dead.
Sure.
Okay?
Sure.
So the dead will not be able to even come into the kingdom of heaven.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
The church is going to advance even against death. And that's where we get our afterlife stuff from.
Oh.
Not merely defending itself. Yeah.
Oh. So instead of actually, so it could just be a reference of defeating death, basically.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It is interesting, but I still hate it.
I hate it, but it's interesting. It's
what's interesting is that the Christians think it's one thing, but it's actually even more aggressive than what they think it is.
Right.
Because they're thinking that death can't even ruin heaven. And they're like, no, actually what it means is that heaven is going to hold back hell and the afterlife and the undead.
Right.
Like we're saying, you're like, even hell can't get in because hell is big and but they can't though. And we're like, right. But furthermore, heaven is the biggest, baddest motherfucker out there. And heaven is going to kick. So like, they don't even understand the phrase to be able to use it to their fullest.
I mean, that tracks.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, I understood that better than you did, you silly Christians. I mean, once I learned.
Look, there's so many ways you can interpret shit from the Bible that I, even with all the research that we do, I'm not going to pretend like we have the best interpretation of anybody out there. Like, no. I'm sure that we don't. But it's interesting to see all these different variations on how you could interpret the Bible in a multitude of different ways through all these different slightly different interpretations that you can take from it, you know? And it's just, it's no wonder there's so many different sects of Christianity.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's very just confusing to me why people are so unwilling to ask questions when there are so many questions to be asked.
Yeah.
You know, like, because there really are, like, it's a trove of fucking questions is what the Bible is.
And it could be so much interest, like, it could be so much more interesting.
Yeah.
If we could just all, like, learn together and ask questions. Like, think of all of the questions we're not even thinking to ask.
If you started from a position of faith, right? Like, let's just, I'm just going to pretend Christian here for a second, right?
Okay.
I'm going to pretend Christian. I'm a
Christian. Husband is a Christian. Go.
Only for a minute. But you would start from a position of faith, right?
Yeah.
And then allow yourselves to question the things and learn what your faith means through these things as you interpret them to the best of your ability. Because wouldn't you, as a good Christian, wouldn't it be incumbent upon you to learn God's word to the best of your ability?
Yeah, but Jesus said, don't ask any questions. Get in the car.
I'm not asking questions. I'm not asking questions other than I'm trying to understand. That I'm not asking questions about anything other than what is written, but I'm still trying to understand.
No, just get in the car.
Whatever.
That's what Jesus is saying.
This is why I'm not a Christian.
I know. It's true. It's so true.
Like, among other reasons.
No questions, then I'm out.
Right, yeah.
All right, here's another side note. I love these side notes.
Yeah.
They're not like, these side notes are not like from the scripture itself. They're just like historical little tidbits that make it more real. Like, so here's what this city was about. So here's the meaning of this word, which lends more, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay, so this
is... Wait, before you move on. Should we subtitle this one, Husband Converts to Christianity?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Rage bait. I love it.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. This chapter, this is the first time that Matthew uses the word church.
Okay.
That's a big deal.
Sure.
Because, like, we haven't used that before.
Right, because it's been temple with the Jews and, you know, like
synagogue.
Church. So now we have a church.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I'm sure there's some meaning behind the word church or something that is significant, maybe?
Well, it comes from the Greek word ecclesia.
Okay.
And I'm sure I mispronounced that. Apologies.
Sure.
Which means an assembly, a gathering, or a congregation.
Okay.
So, which that tracks. That's kind of what a church is.
Yeah.
People would now say that it means a tall, fancy building with stained glass windows and a pipe organ.
Right.
But no, it's actually just a gathering of people.
Sure. Okay.
An interesting wrinkle here is that Jesus lived decades before Christianity existed as a separate religion.
Okay.
And so many scholars suspect that the use of this term reflects concerns of Matthew's later community rather than the exact wording of the historical Jesus.
Hmm. Okay.
When Matthew uses the word church on this rock, my church will be built.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah, Jesus probably did not use that term.
I'm betting that a lot of the terms that Jesus used, quote unquote, were not actually used.
But that would have been one of them.
Right.
Just so we know.
Sure.
That what I just said there is very controversial in a lot of churches.
Yeah.
Because they want to believe that Jesus was all about churchy church.
Sure.
But he wouldn't have known that word.
Right.
This is also a very common scholarly observation, apparently.
Okay.
So I felt like it was really important to bring that, side note to the table.
Right, right.
Because it's fun.
Yeah.
When I can say. All right. But let's get back to chapter 16.
Yeah.
Okay. So once Peter identifies Jesus as Messiah, Matthew et al., the writers, begin steering relentlessly, like at a breakneck speed toward Jerusalem. Okay.
Right,
the pace changes, the themes change, the mood changes, and the miracles are going to become less important than his destiny. So we're not going to see a lot of the miracles anymore.
Okay.
This is going to be about
he's got to go die.
Yeah. This is going to be about his death story.
Okay.
Okay. that let's not forget going forward that this chapter was where it all changed, which is why this made a really decent stopping point.
Yeah.
When I grouped these chapters.
Sure.
I didn't realize that's what this stopping point was.
Right.
It was suggested that this was a stopping point, and now we know why. It is the hinge.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
After that, Jesus foretells his death, right?
Yeah.
And he's like, my guys, I'm going to suffer. It's going to fucking suck, and I'm going to hate it. And I'm going to die.
Yeah.
And immediately Peter's like, don't talk like that. No.
Right.
And then,
Jesus turned into a fucking raging asshole.
Get behind me, Satan.
Right.
And we were like, what the fuck? You just said he's the rock.
Yeah.
You're going to build your church on.
Right.
And now you're saying he's Satan. What the fuck? We were so confused. Like, that was the quickest turnaround.
Right.
Like, you've been promoted to admiral, and then 2 seconds later, get out of here. You're an ensign now. Like,
right.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
Okay. So our question was, why did Jesus react like that and call him Satan?
Yeah, it did seem quite out of place.
It was weird.
Yeah.
It was really fucking weird.
Right.
This is one of the funniest reversals that we're going to see in all of the Gospels.
Okay.
So it's good that we stop to be like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
So what happened was Peter hears Jesus say, I'm going to Jerusalem to suffer and die. This right. is the thing that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And so Peter's like, no, you're not. Don't. And so Peter thinks that this is like encouragement. Like he's with his buddy, his teacher, his guy he loves.
I took it as a very human reaction to what he's saying. You know, like that's definitely something that almost anybody would say.
Sure. Right? Sure. But to Jesus, and putting aside what we think actually happened or not, okay?
Right.
In the story, in canon, to Jesus, this is temptation. Because we're supposed to recall back in chapter 4, Satan had offered Jesus a path that avoided suffering.
Okay. But look, that he got offered by the devil 3 times, mm-hmm. right? And all 3 times, he's like, nah, dude, I'm good.
Right.
You know, like it wasn't any big deal.
But now he's getting closer to it and he's developed relationships, right?
Yeah.
So Peter accidentally offered the same thing, like unknowingly. He's right. speaking the same words that Satan spoke. And now Jesus is further along and he's like, no, fuck you for saying that. Get behind me, Satan. Like, no. Peter is inadvertently the voice of temptation.
Okay.
And whereas, like, in the beginning, it was easy to turn it down.
Right.
Now he's being tempted again. And it's a little bit harder now. It's still not hard, but it's a little bit harder because he is further along in his journey and he has developed the relationship and the following.
Sure.
He's in trouble now more. So he has more at stake and the temptation would be greater.
Right.
And especially coming from somebody he loves.
Sure.
Right? That he literally just said, you're my rock.
Yeah.
And then his rock tempted him. Like, okay. Oh, man.
Right.
So Jesus is like, bro, right now you're speaking the devil's agenda and I'm not having it. And when he says you're a stumbling block, what he means is I need a minute because you're stepping in the way of what I believe I must do.
Sure.
And this is going to be harder than I thought it was.
Right.
So that's what Jesus is telling Peter.
Okay. All right.
Do I buy all of that? Do I think that that conversation actually happened that way? Do I think that Jesus is like, get behind me, Satan?
Right.
Do I think that there is a Satan? Do I think that Satan tempted him? Do I think that there's this parallel to be drawn in the first place? No. But that's what we're supposed to, as readers, take from that story.
Sure.
So I appreciate that knowledge, even though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm still skeptical.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So Jesus declares his expectation that his followers are going to follow him by dying. And he teaches them the necessity of self-denial. Okay.
They're supposed to die too?
They're going to die in spirit.
Ah.
Okay.
Okay.
It's going to be rough.
Okay.
And they're going to have to make some choices now that they have committed.
Okay.
And, yeah, so he teaches them that they're going to have to go through some self-denial, like he just did.
Sure.
You know? We get the paradox of the cross, finding life by losing it, and Jesus speaks of a future judgment to come.
Okay.
Okay. And then we get to see a promise of the Son of Man coming into his own kingdom. Okay.
Yeah.
And then that wraps up the chapter, and we're like, whoa, this like escalated quickly. Yeah, and yeah. Like, what even are we signed up for here?
This has been, I mean, it's been a whirlwind, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, we get, like, he was born, and then boom, he's fucking fully grown and being baptized by John the Baptist, right?
Yeah.
And then we get
just we get five minutes of story.
Yeah. And then we get a litany of fucking miracles that he's doing. John the Baptist loses his head, and then Jesus is promoted to, like, head whatever guy, kind of.
Yeah.
Like, he gains more of a following, it seemed like, at that point. Mm-hmm. Like, he's becoming more popular once John the Baptist is out of the picture.
Right.
Right? And then now we're just like, and now we're prophesizing his own death. And we're marching towards, you know, that whole story.
Right.
And it's like, wow, this is... There is no development here. We're just going boom, 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 boom,
boom.
And
then this, and then this, and then this.
Right. And we commented on it early. It's all prophecy stuffing. It's all just like...
Prophecy it's creating.
Right. They obviously have this Jesus story myth that they had built over the years since Jesus had died into some sort of a structure of types, right?
Yeah.
And they're laying it out in the best way that they think they can.
Yeah.
And they're doing it in a very... digestible, quick manner.
Right.
Like it's not overly written with it's very concise.
Yeah.
Like they're like, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened, that happened.
I still want to know what happened to his missing childhood.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that would be some great reading.
Yeah.
Honestly.
No, and that's why that we talked about that book Lamb.
Yeah.
I can't remember the novel.
Christopher Moore.
Christopher Moore.
Yeah.
And like that kind of covers some of that in a funny, fun way.
Tongue in cheek the whole time. Yeah.
So that's a really great, fun book.
Yeah. So. So good. So good. All right. One more side note.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. In this chapter, we see the Pharisees and the Sadducees team up against Jesus.
They teamed up?
They teamed up. And it was kind of weird. Because them teaming up doesn't happen because historically these groups disagreed on a lot.
Oh yeah.
The Sadducees were temple elites, wealthy aristocrats, conservative about scripture, and they didn't believe in resurrection.
Right.
The Pharisees were more populist. They accepted oral traditions. They believed in resurrection, and they were more influential among ordinary people.
Sure.
They're closer to what we see in Judaism today.
Right.
They are not enemies in the modern sense, but they did represent different factions, which we've talked about before.
Yeah.
Matthew often combines them into a single opposition block.
Okay.
And refers to them like as the same bad guys.
Yeah.
Because his focus is theological rather than political.
Sure.
And so sometimes we don't know which ones he's actually talking about.
Okay.
He like just uses the term generically.
Sure.
Pharisees, whatever.
Okay.
But sometimes it might not be the Pharisees. Sometimes it might be the Sadducees.
Especially since who they're talking to, like the Jesus followers are talking to a very people of the streets type group anyway. So the people that they would know would be the Pharisees.
Exactly.
So when you're talking about not Jewish, you'd be, and you say Pharisees, they're going to understand immediately what you're saying.
Exactly.
So it's just an easy
shorthand.
Shorthand. Yeah.
Yeah. But it is important for us, you and I, and our listeners to know that Pharisees weren't always Pharisees.
Right.
Sometimes they were actually the aristocrats, the Sadducees.
Right. Okay? And oftentimes when he says Pharisees, probably the Sadducees are part of that criticism as well.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
But in this chapter, they were like teamed up against Jesus.
Sure.
And that is why I wanted to make sure we understand that distinction.
Okay.
A modern day analogy might be something along the lines of the Democrats and Republicans both hate this one guy enough to sit at the same table.
Got it.
Like
Like Elon Musk?
Or John Fetterman?
Sure.
Because, I mean, the Republicans hate him because he's a Democrat, period, the end. But the Democrats don't want him either.
Yeah.
So it's like, actually, guys, we all agree on this one thing.
Right.
For different reasons.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So that is the Q&A over Little Maddie, chapter 16. Did you have anything else to add?
I don't think so. I said most of what I wanted to say throughout, and it was a good chapter. It covered a lot of stuff. And I do want to say this before we get out of here. If you're listening to this when it comes out, we do have our live Discord tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern. Mm-hmm. So the link for that is always in the show notes. We would love for you to show up.
That's every Tuesday.
Every Tuesday, 10 p.m. Eastern. And if you don't make it until 10:30 or 11,
you haven't missed anything.
You probably still haven't missed anything. We tend to talk for quite a bit before the show actually starts. So.
Yeah, we like to hang out with everybody and do a little chit-chat before we start reading whatever chapter we're on.
Hell, even you can pop in for the first hour and just chat. You know, like that's kind of one of those fun things. A lot of our people that are regulars on Discord pop in and out, you know, throughout the early section
and then just
come in and say hi or
they peace whatever. Out when we start reading.
Right.
They just come to say hello.
Yeah. If you're worried about not being caught up or something like that, don't.
Yeah.
I mean, you're listening to this now. So if you're listening to it today, then you're caught up.
Right.
But
don't feel like you have to.
But you don't have to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All right. I think that's all we got. That was Matthew chapter 16 Q&A.
Sure as fuck was.
And we will be back tomorrow with our live and we'll be reading
Little Maddie chapter 17.
All right. We'll see you then.
Bye.
Hey, wife, I guess that's the end.
But husband, that's just sad.
It doesn't have to be. We are on lots of social media platforms like Twitter. Our handle there is sacrilegious_D.
For D's nuts.
Oh my God. Stop doing that. Anyway, we're also on Facebook, Instagram, and Pinterest. There's a link to all of our social media sites at our website.
Ooh, we have a website?
Yeah, it's sacrilegiousdiscourse.com, where you can also find a link to our merch shop.
We have a merch shop?
Yep. We have podcast-themed clothing, mugs, notebooks, and more, as well as an atheist and science-themed products.
Wow, our fans should really go check that out right now.
Definitely. They can get in touch with us by sending an email to sacrilegiousdiscourse@gmail.com. But before they do that, we could really use some help.
Oh yeah? With what?
Well, it's not free running the podcast, and we need some financial support in order to get better equipment, which will free up time so we can concentrate on our podcast and our fans.
Okay, so what should they do?
Head over to patreon.com/sacrilegiousdiscourse and sign up as a contributor on our podcast. Supporters there receive additional bi-weekly episodes that we record just for our Patreon members for as little as $2 a month.
Also, we'd really appreciate it if you would like and subscribe on whatever platform you're using.
And Apple Podcast reviews help us out tremendously.
Like and subscribe. Leave an Apple review. Join us on Twitter. Support us on Patreon. That's a lot of instructions. Don't forget to say thanks.
Thanks.
Okay, bye.